Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the course of 6 years, Academy Award-winning director Laura Poitras was granted unprecedented access to Julian Assange and his team, filming them as they broke one big story after another. The result, a film called Risk, is not only a complex portrait of the people behind WikiLeaks, but also about the modern surveillance state and the threats that investigative journalism now face from governments intent on rooting out leakers. It opened last Friday at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. It's my great pleasure to welcome Laura Poitras back to our show. Hello.
It's great to be here with you again.
What's the timeline between this and Citizen 4, your Academy Award-winning documentary about Edward Snowden?
Yeah, I mean, they sort of intersect. So what had happened, I began filming with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in 2011. And I was filming with them, and I moved to Berlin to start to work on the editing. And that's when I started receiving these mysterious anonymous emails from a source. And didn't know who it was. At first, actually, I was pretty suspicious and thought, maybe this is the FBI trying to use me to entrap Julian. And that was my first thought. And then I started to take it seriously. And I thought for a while that maybe it was one film because there were some overlapping themes. They crisscross. And went to Hong Kong, did the filming there, and then returned back to Berlin and realized, no, I can't tell both these stories in one film. So they forked.
Did the work that you'd done on this film, in which you learned about secure communications, encryption, source protection, navigating publication of classified information, help you in making Citizen 4?
Absolutely. I mean, filming with Julian and WikiLeaks, I had to get really up to speed on encryption and secure communication and securing my footage. They were already under investigation when I started filming. I was also on a watch list, so I was, you know, very protective of protecting the footage. And
you've included a little bit about the Snowden situation, also what happened to Chelsea Manning. There's a sequence on Arab Spring and some other stories that broke along the way. How long after working on Citizen 4 did you return to Julian Assange?
So as I said, I realized that it couldn't be in one film, and then I finished Citizen 4, and I wasn't quite sure what I would do. And one of the reasons was I couldn't return to the UK. Legal advice was not to go there because Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, had been stopped under the terrorism law. So I couldn't go there and continue filming. But then after I finished Citizen 4, I said, okay, I have to go back to it, and return to it in 2015.
And you didn't have problems? So you have been stopped at borders a lot.
I have been, but currently I haven't been stopped in the last few years. But you hear in the film, there's this FBI recording where they're discussing me, and that's a relatively recent recording from 2016.
When you returned, did you see things differently after you'd worked on the Snowden film?
Yeah, I mean, I had filmed with Julian and then went to Hong Kong and wasn't able to return for, it was over, I think, 2 years. And I definitely saw the physical toll that that it was taking on Julian being inside the embassy for that long.
He's in a little room. He had earlier been in a much more comfortable situation, even though he also just couldn't travel.
Right. I mean, he was fighting extradition to Sweden for this investigation around sexual assault allegations, and so he was fighting that. And he was first in a large house you see in the film, and then he gets political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And the political asylum is because of threats in the U.S. and the investigation.
And you were there at the time that he moved from one place to the other. We see him putting on false contact lenses to change the color of his eyes, dyeing his hair. His mother enters the scene. It's a really shocking sequence. You just happened to be there at that moment?
You know, so I had no idea that that was happening. So that Julian is very careful about what he shares with who. So a lot of people in the organization had no idea that he was going to be seeking asylum. And you see in the film that first I'm in a car and I thought I was going to court. And then we stopped to meet his mother. So I walked into the hotel room with no idea what was going on. And then I see that he's changing appearances. No one's talking because they're worried about being surveilled. His mother's a bit nervous that I'm filming, but I figure if I'm here and I have a camera, I have to film. So I'm just sort of just responding to things as they're happening.
Didn't you show Risk at Cannes a year ago? How much has changed since then?
So the film has changed a lot. I did screen it last year and knew at the time that the film wasn't done for a couple of reasons. There were some pressures before that screening. Julian wanted me to remove scenes from the film that relate to the Swedish case and him talking about the women involved with that.
But you haven't.
And I didn't. And he was very upset about that. And there's a text that he sent me about that the film is a threat to his freedom and he's going to forced to treat it accordingly. So that happened. And then 2 weeks later, new allegations emerged around another person in the film, sexual abuse allegations around Jacob Applebaum. And after that, I just knew I had two choices. One was not to release I had to continue working on it. Releasing that cut, I knew I couldn't.
And when did there come a time when you just had to say, enough, this film is finished?
Yeah.
How many times had you thought it was finished?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, what happened was we kept working on it because I needed to I think, address the sort of gender issues and gender dynamics that had come up. And then we were working on it in the summer, and then the DNC leaks happened in the Podesta. So we knew that, of course, we had to continue to follow through the election cycle.
You could probably continue doing it right now.
I don't know. I mean, I feel it's done. For me, it was the Comey hearing when you have the director of the FBI saying there's an investigation into the elections and a sitting president. That was like, okay, I have an ending here. So
I'm speaking with Laura Poitras, whose film Risk opened last Friday to very nice reviews at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. What led you first to approach WikiLeaks in 2010?
So I had been documenting post 9/11 America for several years. I'd made a film about the war in Iraq, and I'd made a film about Guantanamo in Yemen, and I was, I think, deeply concerned about the failure of the mainstream media to really accurately cover what the U.S. was doing in our foreign policy. And then WikiLeaks published first the collateral murder video and then later the war logs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I thought that we needed this, we were finally learning what the U.S. government was doing in these wars. And so I reached out at that time.
I remember when a producer on the show came to me with this story. He said these people were... there's an Apache helicopter video documents U.S. soldiers gunning down Iraqi civilians and some Reuters journalists as well. We have to do something on it. I said, what's WikiLeaks? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, everybody knew what WikiLeaks was. So you were there fairly early.
Yeah. I mean, I had actually been following WikiLeaks before that. They had done some other releases around Guantanamo, so they were on my radar. But for me, Julian is he's sort of a game changer in terms of understanding the internet and understanding how the internet would transform global politics for better and for worse, and also how it would transform journalism. And so I like to film things that are happening in real time and people who are sort of in history, like making decisions that are impacting us and creating primary documents.
How do you think Assange imagined your film would depict him?
I avoid speaking for Julian.
Because he kind of says he wants to be seen as a brave man of principle who's willing to risk imprisonment and worse by leaking classified data about governments and big corporations that he feels the public has a right to know.
Right. I think that's in the film, but I also think you see a darker side of him in the film, and a sort of a spectrum, a nuanced portrait that shows some things that are dark and disturbing, particularly some of the things he says about the women in the Swedish case. But then he does things that are I believe are incredibly brave, and then some things I'm very critical of in terms of his publishing. So I want to represent all of that.
At one point, you say in a voiceover, I thought I could ignore the contradictions. I thought they were not part of the story. I was wrong. They're becoming the story.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I wrote down in a production journal as I was filming, because the film feels like it plays like a tragedy. I began filming with a lot of hope. It was right in the Arab Spring. There was a sense of the internet democratizing populations. Then we look at today and we see something like the internet being used by state actors to manipulate outcomes of, you know, it seems like a really dark moment. So, and then there were the contradictions in Julian himself that are in the film that I felt had to be part of the film.
Well, the hacking story has changed over the years. But what impact did the release of the Iraq war log, the Afghanistan war log, the State Department cables, the recent CIA leak actually have? Is what WikiLeaks does journalism?
I definitely believe it's journalism, and we should all be concerned with the threats that we're hearing right now from the Attorney General and the Director of the CIA, which isn't to say I don't have differences of opinion and criticisms of some of their choices. I don't agree with their choices to often not redact things and some of their release choices, but I think there's no doubt that the Podesta emails had newsworthy information. I mean, the Goldman Sachs speeches by Hillary Clinton, the public should know. It is journalism.
Do you see the case against him and WikiLeaks as being about First Amendment issues? James Comey called WikiLeaks intelligence porn, and CIA Director Mike Pompeo claimed recently that WikiLeaks is not a news publication subject to First Amendment protections, but rather a non-state intelligence agency hostile to U.S. interests.
I think we should be really concerned about this language. I think it's really chilling. I think targeting any publisher with this kind of rhetoric it would be foolish to think it's not going to be directed at the work that I do, the work that you do. And speaking from the perspective of actually being myself on a government watch list, right? So I think we should be really careful about this kind of rhetoric.
And then Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the United States is considering filing criminal charges against Assange. He was fearful of that all along, but now it looks like a reality.
They've been saying things that are very frightening. I mean, Sessions' comments were actually broader than just WikiLeaks. He said leakers, and so he's talking about sources, and he's talking about published and people who receive information. So he's not just talking about WikiLeaks when he's talking about putting people in jail at the end of the film.
When did the contradictions start becoming a problem for you? Was it when you were filming his statements about what was going on with the charges from Sweden?
Yeah, I think so. There was that, and that I began filming thinking I was making a film really about journalism, and then it also became a film about gender dynamics and some allegations, and more just a culture maybe of sexism within the hacker community, but not just in the hacker community, but I'm interested in how that reflects on other communities, that it's not the first time an a movement or an organization has internal dynamics that are sexist.
Well, he's obviously very aware of his image. Every time the camera's on, his eyes seem to dart to the lens. He almost poses at times. The only time I've ever talked to him was on the radio, so I didn't see any of that, but we have it on film. So should we be surprised that he made some of those statements that can be taken as sexist to the point of misogynistic?
I mean, I've been doing observational filmmaking for a long time, and I'm always looking for moments that are sort of this have authenticity. And I think you're right that the camera never disappears with anyone. And sometimes I think it becomes a catalyst for things, but I also think it captures something authentic about people. So am I surprised that he said? Yeah, I mean, personally, I was surprised that he was saying those things at all, and then also saying them on camera.
He said that the two Swedish women who have accused him of sexual assault were spurred on by radical feminists.
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation. He was saying that he was making this argument that it was a coordinated radical feminist positioning thing, is I think his quote.
Although he does definitely denies the allegations.
Absolutely. I'm very concerned about the lack of due process in this case. I mean, it's been 6 years and no charges have been filed. I mean, people need to remember that. So everyone deserves, you know, due process, and this kind of a delay is really troubling, but which isn't to sort of excuse some of his words.
But that's why this film feels a little more complicated than Citizen 4, because there are all sorts of unresolved issues here, and some of them are issues of principle, and others are issues of personality.
Yep. I mean, the film begins with this statement where he's saying that you have to be ruthlessly pragmatic, that he has to survive. And I think that sort of captures something about Julian and power. I think it's a film also about power.
I'm speaking with Laura Poitras, whose latest film is Risk. It opened last Friday at the IFC Center and the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Laura Poitras. Her latest film is called Risk. And it is about a whole bunch of things, but I guess most people are going to call it the Julian Assange film. It opened last Friday at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and the Alamo Draft House, Brooklyn. When you started doing it, did you think of it as the Julian Assange film?
Yeah, I was interested in Julian. I mean, you know, and WikiLeaks. I mean, they are separate, and the mission is, but they're, you know, they are also one and the same. I mean, this is his idea, this concept of having an anonymous submission system where sources can leak large data sets and then to publish them. I think that's Julian's idea.
You seem to be filming fairly late into the story, despite the fact that he was unhappy with you.
Well, you know, the way that it works as a filmmaker, you know, you're filming, and then when I presented, I showed him the film before I was going to make it public, which I do with people who I make films about.
This is before Cannes?
Yeah, this is before Cannes, and I have total journalistic independence over the film, but I showed it to him, and that's when he asked me to remove scenes from the film, and that seemed to me sort of highly ironic from someone whose mission is, you know, transparency to try to take these things out, which are his own words. You know, it's this. I was surprised by that.
You know, most people who saw the film at Cannes feel that it's become much darker since. So he was upset even by what was generally seen as a very positive film about him.
That's correct. And the film has become darker, and partly because of the third act that is now the third act of the film, which is in 2016, which includes the presidential elections, hadn't happened yet. I mean, so that is an addition, and it makes it a much darker film.
And something else that you alluded to before, the story about Jacob Applebaum, who we first meet in the film as he's being rather tough questioner during Arab Spring, maybe even pushing a little too hard, but kind of admirable. And then it turns out that he also has engaged in questionable behavior.
Right. 2 weeks after it was screened in Cannes is when a series of allegations came forward. And again, these are allegations that I felt I needed to include in the film, and partly because I had a knowledge of a situation where he was abusive to someone that I'm close to. So I felt that had to be in the film.
And you also revealed that you had a relationship with him. Do you feel that kind of transparency is so important that you even talk about your own personal life?
Yeah, I mean, I say in the film that we had a brief involvement, and partly that is because I felt that as the filmmaker, and I was going to bring in these allegations, and also the knowledge that I had about somebody who I know he was abusive towards, that I had an obligation to, and this had happened after it actually happened. The involvement happened after I had finished filming. But I did feel it was important if I was going to bring in the allegations.
Now, your style is often called cinema verite, but cinema verite, as I always understood it, was the fly on the wall approach. You have become a participant in your films. At least your voice participates in the film.
Yeah, with this film, with Risk and both with Citizen Four, I was pulled into the story, and it was because of what Edward Snowden contacting me. So I'd been filming with Julian and WikiLeaks, and really from an outsider perspective and observational. And then I was contacted by a source, and then I was pulled into that story, and then Julian and Sarah Harrison assisted Edward Snowden's asylum process. And so things got, I became part of the story and a participant in the course of making it.
Do you think that WikiLeaks acted responsibly in releasing the DNC emails?
So this is, I've been asked this a lot. I've been doing a lot of press.
Well, because many people feel it affected the election.
Right.
And that perhaps he's very cagey when you ask him about that.
My feeling about it is, so what we know is, what the government alleges, in which they haven't provided a lot of evidence, but this is what we, that there was hacking of the DNC and the RNC by Russia, and that they then used a cutout or intermediary, somebody else, you know, third party to submit it to WikiLeaks. That's what's been, but not everything, only the DNC. And then Julian published that. I think that not all of the information that was published is newsworthy, and I would have redacted names. But I do think that absolutely there was newsworthy information, and that the DNC emails were also covered by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and every major media outlet. But it does raise new questions for journalism in this sort of new era of massive leaks, internet, state actors, etc. And we just saw this again happening in the elections in France. And I think the media took a very good response to that. It's like, yes, we're going to look at this information. We will report from it, but we're not going to do this in a 24-hour news cycle. We're going to take time. But I don't think that the media should be in the role of censor.
Some charge that Assange was motivated to publish the hacked material out of personal animus toward Hillary Clinton. Do you think that's likely?
Again, you know, if you look at Julian's history and what he wrote about WikiLeaks when it was founded in 2006, he's really consistent. He publishes. He's sort of an equal opportunity leaker. If he had if he had Trump's tax returns, we would have seen them by now. So does he have criticisms about the U.S. politics in general? Absolutely. But I don't think he's releasing information for sort of ideological advantages.
Although he hosted an interview show that was broadcast by the Russian television network RT. And I guess that's why some people suspect that he has allowed himself to be a vehicle for the Russian hackers.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm just going to ask you to, you know, what is the source for that?
He was on RT. I guess that's the source. We don't know, right? Maybe we need somebody who does a WikiLeaks on WikiLeaks.
Yeah. Okay. I'm all for that. I support that. But I think, you know, they did do a television show, and it was funded through RT. But I don't know that then, you know, creates a conspiracy. I need a little bit more than that. And I think that we should just be a little bit careful. I mean, I accept the government's position that this was, that the hack was done by Russia in order to impact the elections, and that then they made the choice using a cutout intermediary. I then to jump that this was a complete conspiracy with WikiLeaks. I haven't seen evidence to support that.
My guest is Laura Poitras, whose latest film, her follow-up to her Academy Award-winning Citizen Four, is Risk. It is currently at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and also at the Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've talked in the past about you having been stopped when you've tried to enter or re-enter the United States. Haven't you instituted a FOIA request for more information about what's happened?
It's actually not I did do a FOIA request, which was non-responsive. Now we're doing a FOIA lawsuit. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation is doing the case, and they've been getting information from the government. We've gotten about 1,000 pages of documents, some of them heavily redacted, but they include FBI documents, which indicate that there was a grand jury investigation into me that was launched in 2007, that it was at the top, well, it was at its secret level, secret no foreign level, that they did things like send FBI agents to film screenings when I was doing Q&As to report back. So it was a pretty in-depth investigation. We don't know, the documents are heavily redacted, so there's a lot of information we don't have.
Well, what do you think they're looking for? After all, you're pretty open about what you do. You produce films that reveal what you've been up to. What do you think that they're hoping to find that you're not revealing yourself?
You know, that's really a question for the FBI. I'd love to have an answer for that. I simply don't know. I mean, I think that they've created a narrative, and that, you know, the narrative is not based on any facts. I mean, there's...
But I suspect that you become more guarded as a result.
You know, and ironically, and I've said this before, that the fact that the U.S. government put me on this watch list then made me really good at encryption. I mean, they kind of a sort of unintended consequences that then I was able to do things like report on the Snowden material, because they made me have to make a choice. Am I going to keep doing this work, or am I going to stop doing it? If I'm going to keep doing it, then I have to protect myself, protect my sources, and get really smart about doing that.
And the work is more than making feature films. You did an installation about surveillance called Astro Noise at the Whitney Museum of American Art last year.
Yeah, that was a great experience working at the Whitney. It allowed me to sort of work in more non-linear ways, you know, to still use narrative around similar themes around surveillance, around America post 9/11, but to do it in a more non-linear way. So it was an incredible experience for me to team up with that.
And what were you trying to reveal with that show?
It's too...
We were originally planning to have you come on here, but circumstances, scheduling problems prevented it from happening. So let's take a few minutes to talk about it now.
Yeah, I mean, I had several rooms to work with, and it allowed what you can do in a museum space, you can use space to let the viewer, the audience, actually navigate the narrative. So it was a lot of images and actually documents also from the NSA archive from Edward Snowden. And it sort of was taking a journey or taking the audience on a journey through a landscape of post 9/11 America, through surveillance, but one that they were able to navigate rather than, you know, you make a movie, people sit in a theater, hopefully not always, and don't get to move around or decide when to engage or how long to engage.
Focus longer on this than that.
Exactly.
Are you still in touch with Edward Snowden?
I am. Yeah, I actually just got a text from him.
How's he doing?
Recently.
Because he's trapped. Julian Assange is trapped. Edward Snowden is trapped. Do we have any thoughts about whether they will ever get out?
They both have political asylum. I think it's one of the answer to that question is we'll find out when we find out, because I would hope for both of them to be able to travel to someplace other than where they are. But Ed is good. I mean, he's been remarkably, I think, able to use the platform that he has to talk about this issue that he's risked so much, which is the dangers of surveillance.
Well, he's got more freedom also. He's not trapped in one room. And then there was talk about the possibility that the election in Ecuador might endanger Assange's ability to stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
That's right. There was a recent presidential election, and one of the candidates was voiced that opinion, but that candidate was defeated.
Now, a lot of people have used the word paranoia in talking about this film. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that your executive producer, Sam Esmail, is the creator of Mr. Robot on cable television.
So Sam is great, and Mr. Robot, I mean,
I watched the first season, although I've drifted away.
Yeah, I think it's really the smartest show on television. It really treats the audience as being incredibly smart. It's got plot twists you do not see coming, and it was really inspiring for me for Risk. It came out when I was returned to this footage, and it captures something like a lot of times Hollywood is sort of reactive to what is the zeitgeist, and this show kind of sort of embodies the zeitgeist. It's a hacker is the protagonist, and they're changing world events, which, you know, has obvious resonance to to risk.
So how do you describe yourself? Your bio says filmmaker, journalist, and artist. What do you see as the primary thing there?
I mean, I guess I would say primary that I'm a filmmaker and that the documentary filmmaking I do includes journalism. It's journalism and cinema. And for me, cinema is art. So I guess I would say I'm first and foremost a filmmaker.
I thank you so much for being on our show.
It's a pleasure.
I'm assuming you're involved in another project, but can you tell us anything about it?
I've been doing this project called Field of Vision, where I've been funding filmmakers to do short films that are responsive to the news. So it allows me to just support talented filmmakers. So I'm really excited about that. And I've got another.
So we add curator to the list of things?
I'm just producer, executive producer is what that counts as. And then there's another project I'm really excited about being involved in, but I can't talk about it yet.
Risk is currently on view at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and also at the Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. Laura Poitras, always a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sherry Lansing made history in 1980 when she was the first woman to head a Hollywood studio as president of 20th Century Fox and became, at the age of 35, the highest paid and highest ranking woman in the American film industry. A dozen years later, she would become the chairman and CEO of Paramount Pictures. And now, many, if not all, of the secrets behind the numerous hits made during those years, including Fatal Attraction, Kramer vs. Kramer, Forrest Gump, and Titanic, are told in Stephen Galloway's book, Leading Lady. It's published by Crown Archetype. And we're incredibly lucky to be able to welcome its subject, none other than Sherry Lansing, to our show now. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show, so it's an honor to be here.
Should I be surprised that you didn't write this yourself as a memoir? Had you ever intended to write one?
Actually, I had. When I left Paramount, I had several offers to write my memoir. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of interesting. I'll try it. And so I started to try it, only to discover almost immediately that I cannot write. I am literally the worst writer in the entire world. And you should just look at my emails and you can see. And even when I was at Paramount, I never put anything down in writing because I was terrified of the written word. And I used to put, as per our discussion, attached is. So I found that I couldn't write, and I found something else out
also. But
you
could talk. You could have talked into a tape recorder, and somebody else would have transcribed it.
But here's what happens. I found that I really don't like to look back. I like to live in the present and dream about the future. So it was a process that was very painful and unsatisfying, and so I stopped it. And had I not met Stephen Galloway and had he not been doing this book, and had I not decided to cooperate, there would be no record.
Is it difficult to relinquish control for someone like you who must be used to calling the shots?
It is the most difficult thing in the world. I have to be honest with you. In a moment of weakness and also in a moment of great admiration for the author, I said yes. And the last 4 years, I have been living in a constant state of anxiety, wondering what he would write. I mean, we would meet. He would ask me all these questions. I would get incredibly anxious the next day. The day after that, I was more anxious. Then I'd get depressed. And then I'd think, well, maybe it'll never happen. And it wasn't until I read it over Christmas that I kind of went, okay, I can live with this. There's a lot of things I don't like about it. But unfortunately, they're all true. So I have to accept them.
Had he unearthed things that you didn't know or remember?
Yes. He talked to over, I would say, 300 people. And he found out things that I did not know. And he also found out things that were rather healing, especially in the area of my personal life. For example, he met people who knew my mother. My mother escaped from Nazi Germany, and she would never talk about it. But he met a woman who knew her, who's now 93. And I found out that my mother had been engaged before she married my father, which was shocking to me because she never told me. And it gave me a fuller view of my mother as a rather free-spirited woman who would break convention and who would break an engagement, which was unheard of in those times.
And you've said that everything, I'm quoting, everything I do is in honor of Margaret Margot Hyman, your mother, who you say fled Nazi Germany at the age of 17.
Where did
she come here? Was she able to come here?
My mother escaped, and she met an uncle. His name was Max, who lived in Chicago. And she began her life there, learned English, sold dresses. And when I say everything I do is in honor of her, she was the greatest inspiration in my life. She was my first role model. And in fact, I think of her all the time, especially when we were doing this book. And she died, sadly, from cancer, ovarian cancer, at the age of 64. And so forming Stand Up to Cancer with a group of other women is completely in honor of my mother.
And your father died when you were just 9.
Yes. He died of a heart condition when he was 42. And today he would be alive and well.
You've said that his death filled you with grief, with guilt.
It filled me with enormous guilt, because the night that he died, he had walked across my room. He had been sick for several years, very weak from a damaged heart. And he kind of walked across my room to go out to the porch where there would be cool air, since we didn't have air conditioning. And in my memory, I said, "Oh, Dad, you woke me up. Be quiet." Hmm. My mother says this never happened, but in my mind it happened. And when I woke up in the morning, he wasn't there. He had passed away. And I never really understood as a 9-year-old, because the rabbi said that I shouldn't go to the funeral. I never understood that what death was till later. And so I actually thought he had gone away to another family because I was a bad girl. And so as a child, I constructed this thing in my head that wherever I went, whenever I walked into a big room, or whenever my parents were on the freeway, I would find my dad and I would bring him back to me, because I would be a good girl from then on.
Would anyone looking at you as a kid see the beginnings of a studio head?
I doubt it, except that my cousins say I was very bossy. And my sister remembers that we used to do plays. And I was always the lead in the plays, and I would tell everybody else what to do.
And you began as an actress.
Yes. And that was because I really didn't understand much about making movies. When I was growing up, and I know it sounds like I come from another planet now, but I'm 72 years old, so you have to imagine another time. There really weren't film schools. So I saw all these people on the screen, and I thought, well, that looks good. I'll be an actress, and I'll be one of those. And fortunately, I was cast relatively soon in a movie, only to discover that I couldn't act. And more important than not having talent, I really was uncomfortable being anybody other than myself. And so whenever I would act, I would get this kind of tension in my arms and legs, which was showing how anxious I was at being inauthentic.
But you co-starred with John Wayne in Rio Lobo, so this was not nothing. Howard Hawks directed.
Yes, well, you know, everyone's entitled to make a mistake in casting, but he was a great director. And yes, I'm glad I got those parts. And whether or not if I'd worked harder, you know, and studied more, I could have developed a talent. When I look at it, I'm so humiliated and embarrassed. But Howard Hawks, who was a brilliant director, really didn't want me to be myself. He had created, as you know, many leading ladies.
He made Lauren Bacall talk in a deeper voice.
Well, he made me talk like that, too. And when I would talk like that, I would feel so inauthentic and so fake. And then he wanted me to be very sexy. And no one wanted me to be myself. And so for me, I couldn't distinguish between play acting and reality. And I just felt fake all the time. And that's why I admire actors so much, because they have this ability to transform themselves and be somebody other than themselves. And that is such a gift, and I'm in awe of them.
Speaking with Sherry Lansing, who is the subject of Stephen Galloway's Leading Lady, what kinds of movies did you like when you were a kid? Do you see your tastes reflected at all in what came later?
Yes. From the time I was a child, I loved movies. And I used to go to the double feature on the south side of Chicago at the Hamilton and Jeffrey Theaters.
We actually had triple features sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Could be a whole Saturday afternoon.
Oh, my God. Well, I only remember the double features, but I spent the whole Saturday afternoon there. originally, I remember loving the Audrey Hepburn movies and the romance and learning about love. But then I remember a movie called Imitation of Life. And that movie affected me greatly because it had social issues as well as this emotional thing between a mother and a daughter. And then I remember The Pawnbroker.
But that was Douglas Sirk.
That's right.
Pretty great director.
Amazing
director. Does it matter what that a great director made that movie? In retrospect, as somebody who was a studio head?
It didn't. Well, it didn't at the time. In retrospect, yes, because I'm in awe of the director. And I think if you don't have a good director, you can't make a good movie. And if you don't have a good script, you can't make a good movie. But at the time, I probably didn't even know what a director did when I was 12 or 13 years old. But then I also saw The Pawnbroker. So those two movies influenced me greatly because I saw that film could not just entertain you, but it could actually affect the way you think or feel, and it could actually change social legislation. And that, to me, was the highest form of art.
You went to school. You were the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools and then later a Bachelor of Science degree at Northwestern. You worked for a while as a math teacher.
Yes.
A far cry from the movie biz.
It's a very far cry. But when I was a child, I knew that I wanted to be in the movie business. But whenever I told anybody, they laughed at me. They made fun of me. And so my parents, wisely so, insisted that I get a college education and that I be able to support myself. And so I went to Northwestern and I got a teaching credential in math, which I love, and English, so that I had a skill set so that I could be a teacher, which is my second love. And so when I came out to California, I supported myself by teaching in Watson, East L.A.
And then you also earned $5 an hour as a script reader at one point?
That was after I stopped acting.
Mm-hmm. You say acting made you sick, actually.
It did. I mean, as I said, I got this tension in my arms and legs, and I wanted it to go away. But now I've learned, because it still happens to me sometimes, I've learned that that's my friend. It's telling me when I'm uncomfortable in a situation, and I should embrace it and listen to it. But when I stopped acting, I got a job as a script reader for $5 an hour reading scripts and synopsizing the scripts. And it's really interesting, Leonard, because as uncomfortable as I was acting, when I got this teeny little office, which was so small it could barely have a table and a chair in it, and I started to read the scripts, I felt instantly comfortable. I felt instantly at home, and I knew that's where I belonged.
So did your experience as an actress and then also as a script reader help you when you were dealing with actors and script writers and whatever later in
totally,
your
life? Totally, because having been an actor, even though I was a bad one, I understood the pain, and I understood how you put yourself out there. And so I had great empathy and great respect for actors. Also, because I had a degree in English, I understood literature, I understood the structure of a script. And very early on in my career, a wonderful director named James Bridges, we were working on a movie called The China Syndrome. And I remember saying to him, I don't know, there's something wrong with this scene. And he said to me, well, let's read it. And I said, Jimmy, I can't act. He said, it doesn't make any difference, just read it. And we read it, and he said, because actors have an innate sense of the truth, even though you don't think you can act, you're picking up what you think is wrong. And we did. And that is why I think that actors often make such brilliant directors.
You also had a mentor and a producer, Ray Wagner.
Oh, that was the greatest mentor of all. I mean, Ray was extraordinary. I wish he was alive today to hear the things I say about him because I felt so strongly. He was an incredible producer. He made one of my favorite films called Petulia, and he made a film that I acted in called Loving. And when I wanted to stop acting, I went to him, and he's the first person that gave me a job reading scripts for $5 an hour. I learned from him, first of all, not to be afraid to express your emotions. In a script meeting, he would get very emotional and talk about things. I learned kindness from him because he never said he was right. He would always say, this is my opinion, do you know? And he would listen to people. And he loved film. And I learned from him, I think, really a great deal about script and emotion and script and character. And those days, sitting with him in a script meeting with a writer named Larry Marcus on a movie that was never made called The Man Who Invented a Wife, which was supposed to star George C. Scott, I still think somebody should make it, was among my favorite times in the whole world.
Well, they
he was
talk-
also a man who had great integrity.
They often talk about filmmaking as a collaborative effort, but the producer doesn't get as much credit as the scriptwriter, the director, and, of course, the actors, the editor. These days, when at the start of a film, there are 300 producers, all listed production companies. It takes up one-third of the time of the movie.
So I think it depends very much on who the producer is, because there are producers who just put up the money, there are producers who represent the talent, and then there are what I would call the creative producer, and that's what Ray was, and that's what Stanley Jaffe, my partner, is and continues to be. And they're the producers that often think of the idea for the movie. They are the producers that are there every day in the script meetings. They're on the set every day. They're involved in the casting. They're involved in the marketing of the movie. And that was the producer that I aspire to be.
And when you wound up being the head of the studio, were you still hands-on? Did you go
to
the set?
My favorite job was when I was a producer for I guess, 10 years. And so when I took the job at Paramount, which I loved, and I also loved the job at Fox, so I'm not in any way saying I didn't like it, I wanted to continue to think of myself not as a suit, but as the executive producer on all the movies. But the truth is, I was one step removed. I couldn't go to the set, obviously, every day. I had you know, 12 movies to plus worrying about the commissary and plus worrying about the parking lot and the financial aspects. So I was lucky.
And the movie that was bombing.
That's right. And the movie that was bombing, and believe you me, there were plenty of them. And the movie that broke your heart, because every movie that we made, I cared about, and I worked just as hard on the failures as the successes. But I have to say that I made it a point to go to every movie, but I was lucky if I could go once. And you're one step removed. And the joy of really getting involved is different. But it's a different kind of pleasure. And I did enjoy both jobs very much.
I'm speaking with Sherry Lansing, who's the subject of Leading Lady, Sherry Lansing, and the Making of Hollywood Groundbreaker, of a Hollywood Groundbreaker. It's written by Stephen Galloway and published by Crown Archetype. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sherry Lansing, who is the subject of a book called Leading Lady, Sherry Lansing, and the Making of a Hollywood Groundbreaker. It's published by Crown Archetype and written by Stephen Galloway. Angelica Houston, with whom you worked on the Addams Family film, said of you that for a woman to have been the head of a studio in this, if you'll forgive me, rather misogynistic town is an extraordinary feat. How blatant was the misogyny when you were moving up the ladder?
So when I was moving up the ladder, I certainly experienced sexism. I mean, I remember when I got a raise and a man had the same job and we both got promoted at the same time. And he got a raise, and I didn't. And I remember going to the head of the company and saying, well, you know, you gave him a raise, so when are you going to give me one? And he said, I'm not going to give you one. You're a single woman, and he's a married man with three kids. Now, today that would be a huge class action lawsuit, but at the time, I was just so grateful to have a job that I accepted it. I think that the kind of sexism that I experienced was, I would say, almost like inept flirts. I never, ever had anyone say to me, if you don't go away with me this weekend, I'm going to fire you. So
you didn't face the casting couch problem that so many women did?
I faced it a little, but you could laugh it off. You could treat it like it was a speck on your jacket, and you could go on. And you, if you continue to work, look, I can't deny that I faced it, but if you continue to work, you did rise within the system. But it was such a different world then. I mean, I have to say, sadly, that there were no women really ahead of us. And I have to say that, and this makes me feel bad, but when I was going through my career, women believed that there was only room for one at the table. So we really didn't bond with each other like women do today. And we really didn't help each other. We really didn't reach out a hand. We thought if we told you about the script, you would do it. If we told you about the job, someone, you would get it, not me. So what happens is that we were a little suspicious. Now, today, you know that what's good for one is good for all, and there's room for all at the table. And I look at these women today and how close they are and how they help each other and how they reach out together, and I can't tell you how happy it makes me. And you can see what happens when women raise their voices. You go to the HR department and say you've been, you know, not treated fairly. All you have to do is look at what's happening today in the media, and people are losing their jobs because of it.
Meryl Streep, with whom you worked on Kramer & Kramer, says that you paved the way for the tsunami of women who now fill the executive ranks of our industry. But what about actresses? There was just a recent report of a woman, an actress, who was turned down for a role because the star, who was older than she was age appropriate, wanted a younger co-star as his wife.
So I think ageism is the biggest problem in the movie industry today. I think that we have made huge strides. It is not perfect. I want to be clear about that. We still have a long way to go with equality, racial equality, and gender equality. But I think ageism is the biggest problem. Hollywood, and actually, I have to say, I think it permeates every business. In Hollywood, when you turn 45, not just as an actor, but as a producer or director, you're considered old. And that's ridiculous. I mean, all you have to do is look at the films that Clint Eastwood is making or Steven Spielberg and say, this makes no sense, or Ridley Scott, or my husband. I mean, so that's all you
Your
have
husband,
to
do. Your husband, William Friedkin.
That's right. Who I'm the biggest director. Fan in the world of, a brilliant director and a wonderful husband. But I've seen this happen over and over and over again. And I've seen it happen in other industries as well. Do you know, one of the missions of my foundation is to redefine aging. I mean, if Mick Jagger can still be jumping up and down at 73, and I can still be jumping up and down, then we can all have valuable encore careers.
Sheila Evans named her book, You Don't Look Your Age and Other Fairy Tales.
Well, I think that we have to change that. I think we have to embrace aging. I think it's very brave to have a facelift, and I think it's very brave not to. I choose not to, but that doesn't mean I judge in any way someone who does. But I think we have to embrace aging. We have to embrace our wrinkles. We have to embrace the wisdom that we have because we've aged. We have to learn that people who have emotional IQ at a certain age, you look back on things that bothered you, they no longer bother you, and we have to start to realize that this encore generation, which are the boomers that fought for civil rights, that fought for the women's movement, should fight for a place in the workplace, voluntary or paying.
You've said that running a studio, you're largely reactive. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what happens is every day you're bombarded with a lot of scripts to read. I used to read probably 26 scripts a week, something like that. Used to take home 10, 12 on a weekend. So you're reacting to the material. Every day you come in and there's a long list of people who are angry about something or who have a crisis. But I'm not saying one or two. I'm saying like 25. And I used to laugh, you know, found out or I'm angry at you about this or whatever. So just to put out the fires every day, you don't have the time that you do when you're a producer where you can say, let's just take a couple of hours today to think about an idea for a movie. You can't do that when you're running a studio because you don't have a couple of hours. You have to just react to the crisis of the moment.
So how do you choose what films to wind up doing?
Well,
is it a matter of financing?
No. For me, there was clear ground rules, and I always found the time to do that. For me, it's all about the script. So I would read all the scripts that came to me. Now, not every script got to me. There are people underneath you who are reading the scripts, sifting through them. But on the weekend, as I said, I often read 12 scripts. And I would read the scripts, and once I found a script that I liked, and what did that mean? I think that filmmaking is an emotional, not a passive experience. So the script should make you laugh or cry, involve you emotionally. And you must be interested in the central character, meaning the character may not be, you know, perfect. It might be gray, but you're rooting for them. When I found something like that, and then it passed what I call the blink test, which is my stomach, it moved me in some way. Once I found that script, I would greenlight it subject to the elements. So I had to find the right director, the right stars to be in it, or actors, they didn't have to be stars, and then balance it with the correct budget. So if I thought the movie should cost $20 million and it was budgeted at $200 million, maybe I didn't make it. If I thought it needed X and Y to be in it or to direct it and I didn't find that, then I couldn't make it. So sometimes I would put them on the shelf and wait. And some of the greatest movies that we ever made took 10 years to make.
Fatal Attraction took a while to find the right director. So what made Adrian Lyne a good fit? And why wasn't Glenn Close, who's just so brilliant in it, the first choice for the role?
Well, that's a great story. So because Stanley Jaffe and I were not attuned at in the beginning to see how great a choice she would have been. A lot of actresses turned down the part. I think about 20 actresses turned down the part. They didn't like the script. They didn't like the character. I mean, one actress actually flew in from Australia on our money just to tell us what a terrible script it was. I remember going into that meeting. And a man named Fred Spector, who represents Glenn Close, called and said, Glenn wants to do the movie. And
she saw it, obviously, as a good part for a good actress.
She saw it as a great part for her. And what happened is Glenn had been in The World According to Garp. She's a brilliant actress, and she had played an Earth mother. So this part is a kind of seductress part. And we just saw Glenn in that Earth mother part. And Fred kept calling back and saying, she wants to come. And I said, I don't want to humiliate her. This is a woman who has either been nominated or won an Academy Award by then. I don't want her to come in and turn her down. She's not right physically for the part. And he kept begging and begging. And finally she did what a great actress always does. Glenn wants to come in. She wants to read. She only asks that she read with Michael Douglas. And when an actress wants to read, you say, okay, because she was way beyond having to read for a part. So she came in, and I remember very clearly, she walked in, her hair was wild, she had on a black dress with a V. She was unrecognizable. She looked so sexy and so amazing. And she started to read with Michael Douglas. And I'm telling you, by the first scene, you knew that she was the part because she knew what we didn't know, that she could be anything. And that Glenn Close is the most brilliant actress. And we laugh about this story because I was so wrong. And thank God the agent was persistent. Thank God she was persistent. But the actress, Glenn, said, I can do anything. And she was right. And I can't imagine anybody else in this part.
Sherry Lansing is our guest. She's the subject of Leading Lady, Sherry Lansing and the Making of a Hollywood Groundbreaker, written by Stephen Galloway and published by Crown Archetype. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Adrian Lyne, he was not the most famous director at the time.
Well, he had done several hits for Paramount, Flashdance being one of them. Adrian has this enormous ability to get performances out of actors. He's also incredible visually. I think he's one of the best directors working in film today. I mean, I can remember Diane Lane in Unfaithful. What Adrian has is besides extraordinary visual style, he has a sense of truth. So this movie in anybody else's hands wouldn't have had the resonance of reality that it has. He made everybody's performance real. So suddenly it wasn't just a scary movie. It was a what-if movie, and everybody could identify with one end of the triangle, and suddenly you thought, this could happen to me. But it's the sense of honesty that he has in performance. He gets the most extraordinary performances from actors combined with an incredible visual style.
James Cameron said of Titanic that everyone thought they were going to lose money on it. Were you scared?
I wasn't scared because, first of all, we had a financial arrangement where we were capped at $65 million and didn't have to pay any more than that for half the movie. So I did sleep well at night. And also I saw the dailies, and then there was a time when James invited us to his cutting room and let us see cut footage, not the whole movie. And I remember watching that cut footage, and it was on a Sunday afternoon, and we started at 12:30, and I had told my husband that I would meet him for dinner at 6:30. And James Cameron shows us the first scene, and I was blown away. I was mesmerized. And then he says, you want to see more? I said, yes. And then he shows us a little more. And then he says, you want to see more? And he shows us a little more. And this went on. And I saw the performances, and I saw the way he used water, and I thought, this is going to be one of the most brilliant films ever. And finally, I said, oh, you know, I better call my husband, because I told him I'd meet him at you know, at 6 o'clock or at 6:30, I can't remember. And he said, Sherry, it's 8:30. Mm. I had lost all sense of time. And so from that moment on, I had no fear. And it's kind of like I thought, well, this film is going to be a masterpiece. And if masterpieces don't work, then everybody should go in another business. I should sell shoes, which is a perfectly honorable profession. But if this doesn't work, nothing will work.
You're universally liked, but you must have had a hard side, too. Is that the reason Mel Gibson threw an ashtray at you?
I wasn't in the room. Mel Gibson, I wasn't in the room. It was a business meeting, but he certainly was angry at me. And we were discussing the budget. And I wanted the budget to be lower, and he wanted it to be higher. But here's the good part of the story. He was frustrated, and I was frustrated, and he was in a meeting with business affairs people. When it was all over and we agreed on the budget, I called Mel, and this is obviously for the movie Braveheart. And I called Mel, and I said, boy, you must have my picture, and you must, you know, on your wall, and you must be throwing darts at it. And he laughed, and he said, no, Sherry, you were just doing your job, and I was doing mine, so let's go on and make the movie. But I want to say one of the hardest things about being a studio executive is you have to balance the budget, how much you think the movie should cost, because you're responsible to the stockholders and the bottom line, with the artistic vision. And you don't want to hurt the movie, but you have to balance both ends of that.
And how does that apply to the story you tell about when you were tussling with Alexander Payne over revisions to his second movie, Election, a movie I like an awful lot?
I love Election. I just saw Alexander a few days ago, and we're very close friends. That wasn't about the budget. That was about creative decisions. And I think what happens, and that was about how the movie should end, and I think what happens, quite honestly, is that I cared passionately about movies, and the filmmaker, in this case Alexander Payne, cares passionately. And passionate people want to do what's best for the movie, and passionate people can disagree. And out of their passion and their mutual respect for one another, they usually come to a collaborative solution. So what happens, like with Alexander Payne, and what Stephen doesn't include in the book, is that all of these people that you have these passionate disagreements with, at the end of the day, they know you care about the movie as not much almost as they do, and then you become friends afterwards.
We're pretty much out of time. So why did you decide to quit at the age of 60?
So at the age of 60, and I think this is kind of a normal evolution, somewhere in my mid-50s, I realized that I was kind of repeating myself. I had been involved by the time I left the movie business in over 200 movies. And I can't say that I can say that the highs weren't as high, the lows weren't as low. It wasn't like I had lost my passion, but my passion was moving to something else. And I always dreamed that if I was successful enough, that I wanted to give back to society, if I fulfilled my dreams. And so I wanted a new life. I wanted a life dedicated to cancer research in honor of my mother, dedicated to public education. I'm a former math and English teacher. And dedicated to Encore Careers, putting retired people back to work. And, you know, change is very good, because after you've done something for a very long time, what happens is that you do repeat yourself. And suddenly, when I left the movie business at the age of 60, I felt as if I was 22 years old again, and like I was just graduating college. And everything was new to me. I had to learn about stem cells. I had to learn about science. And I felt authentic, and I felt young. And so I would encourage other people to take that leap, because these last 10 years have been among the happiest of my life.
Sherry Lansing, still young after all these years, the subject of Leading Lady,
still
Sherry
curious.
Lansing, and the Making of a Hollywood Groundbreaker. The book is written by Stephen Galloway and published by Crown Archetype. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. I loved it. It was fun.
Thank you. Princeton professors Anne Case and Angus Deaton made national headlines when they reported 2 years ago that the death rate of midlife non-Hispanic white Americans had risen steadily from 1999, in contrast with the death rates of blacks, Hispanics, and Europeans. What has gone largely unnoticed, by contrast, is how poverty has shortened the lifespans of poor urban blacks for decades. While he was working for 40 years in hospitals that serve some of the poorest communities in Chicago, Dr. David Ansell witnessed firsthand how disparity takes lives. His latest book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, is published by the University of Chicago Press. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Good morning.
You write that the death gap is not just a problem for urban blacks.
Yes. Well, you know, as a doctor who had the opportunity on one street to work in three different hospitals that serve different communities, literally within 0.8 miles of each other, I learned that there are two worlds. But these two worlds of life and death don't just apply to inner city America, but where you live in the United States dictates when you will die. And that's true if you're a Native American on a reservation in the Four Corners region, or if you are a high school educated white person living in Appalachia, but actually largely across the United States.
So you weren't surprised by all the press that the report by Ann Case and Angus Deaton received?
What was a little surprising to me about it wasn't surprise that poverty and its consequences causes despair, and those that despair causes premature mortality, because that's been the life of black people in this country largely for the last 400 years. It got unusual attention when it began to affect white people, and this has to be noted that it's not like in any other country in the world. So it's a huge death gap occurring, premature mortality, people dying between the ages of 25 and 64. It's, the size of it is bigger than the number of people died in the AIDS epidemic in the 1990s.
But are you also suggesting it got so much attention because it does involve whites? If this affected another group, it might not have made national headlines?
People ask me that. You know, diseases of despair have been around around for many, many years. It does get more attention. It gets a different attention. For example, narcotic overdoses, we say the police should be carrying Narcan. They could have been carrying it in the 1970s. We talk about drug treatment, which is the right way to approach addiction. We talk about addressing despair through really empathy. And it's not the way that we've treated it with is when it's been in an inner city or black or brown people. But I am actually glad it's getting attention because it is a national problem.
Confirming what you just said, a report was published today by the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in which the researchers found that life expectancy can vary by more than 20 years from county to county.
Yes. Actually, the largest gap is 35 years when you take small census tracts, and they're literally a drive away. You can drive a half day and gain or lose 35 years in life expectancy. And really what this is about is concentrated disadvantage or concentrated poverty. It's one thing if you're a poor kid in a wealthy neighborhood, there's a chance for you to lift yourself out of that. You're surrounded by teachers and schools and parks and things. But when you live in concentrated poverty, and neighborhoods of concentrated poverty have doubled in the United States since the 1960s, your chances of ever getting out of that is quite devastating, and it affects literally your chance to live or die.
The most improved life expectancy include remote locations in Alaska and the boroughs of Manhattan and Brooklyn, as well as San Francisco. Life expectancy is also up in Loudoun County, Virginia, and Fairfax County, but it's dropped significantly in Kentucky, Oklahoma, and Alabama. Mortality rates are also up in Appalachia, the Mississippi Delta, and areas of the Dakotas. We have any idea why?
You know, if you have a certain amount of money in this country, it doesn't matter where you live. But where you live when you're poor makes a big difference. And public policy, local public policy makes a giant difference. different. For example, if you are poor in New York or San Francisco, you do better off than if you're poor in a place like Detroit or the Deep South. Some of the highest mortality rates for whites and black people occur in what I call the former slave states.
But the public policy is the same in Chicago, and you have a map of life expectancies in various parts of Chicago. In the Loop, it's 85. In Hyde Park, it's 83. In North Lawndale, it's 72. In Washington Park, it's 69.
Yes. Well, some of these are statewide public policies. For example, how we cover poor people with health insurance. So the current debate is interesting in this way. But in my town, if you live in the Loop, it's like you said, it's 85. Think Japan, number one in the world. But you go three stops from my hospital and it plummets down to under 69. Think Iraq or Bangladesh. And these gaps exist along in every city. In New York, it's about 9 to 10 years. But, you know, these public policies over lifetimes, like how we take care of poor people, how we school children, the opportunity for education vary actually by state and by location.
So education is a factor in life expectancy?
Yes. It's probably the number one factor in life expectancy is education. It's of all the things that we do, and of course poverty and education are linked directly.
What goes into calculating the dissimilarity index? Chicago ranks as the fifth most segregated city in America out of 318. What kind of dissimilarity index does it have then?
Well, if you, in an ideal world, we wouldn't have the kind of racial segregation that we have right now. Turns out that if you survey African-American black people and ask them how they would want to live, most of them do not want to live in concentrated segregation. And so the dissimilarity index is really states what percent of the population would have to move out of a neighborhood to be perfectly integrated into society. And I think Chicago's about 0.84. The degree of concentrated black neighborhoods is quite high. And this is true for poor black neighborhoods, which I talk about a lot, but also middle class and wealthy black neighborhoods. So, segregation, which has been with us for, hundreds of years, is still a problem. But it's not just the segregation, it's the concentration of poverty and segregation together that affects life expectancy.
We see that in New York as well. But when neighborhoods change, then there's another kind of outcry.
Yeah, it's hard to find the right balance. But for many of these neighborhoods, the disinvestment has been an active process. So a neighborhood, it's not like it just rained on the west side of Chicago or in Harlem and things got bad. No, there are active public policies over many, many years that have created these scenarios, and we have solutions to them. And that's why the current health care debate is so important. Because investing in things like healthcare, investing in things like neighborhood revitalization can make a difference in the health as well as the wealth of individuals.
My guest is Dr. David A. Ansell, A-N-S-E-L-L. His latest book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, it is published by the University of Chicago Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned empathy, and you're right that there's an empathy gap. What's that?
You know, it's I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, Binghamton, and I went to the Central High School. We all went to the same high school. My dad was a doctor on Riverside Drive, and, you know, all the different neighborhoods in a small town like that, people interacted with each other. When you live closely with each other, you had to have empathy for your neighbor because you're all the common good was something that made a difference. But I think what's happened, you know, these neighborhoods of concentrated poverty developed in this country because we've actually created neighborhoods of concentrated affluence. There are more neighborhoods of concentrated affluence in this country where people see people just like each other. They've lost any connection to the public good. They say my taxes are they send their kids to private schools. Their kids go to the best colleges. Their eyes never have to light upon one of their poor neighbors. And this is true for obviously black and brown people in inner city neighborhoods, but white people in poor areas of this country.
What's your reaction when a member of Congress says something like no one dies from a lack of access to health care, or that if we just put the money we spend on cell phones into health care, there would be less of a problem?
Well, it's quite shocking that we find ourselves the richest country in the world putting with the most dollars going into health care, and people are saying these things. You know, it does make a difference, access to health care and many of these diseases that we're seeing. So when people die in inner city Chicago and I say, well, what's the cause of it? People think gun violence. And I say, no, the number one cause of death is heart disease, followed by cancer. And the same in when you look in Appalachia or Sacramento, California, for white people, is heart disease and cancer. And these are diseases for which having a good health care system, access to care throughout a lifetime, makes a real difference.
So why do you think people just immediately think it's violence? Is that because of the way we report the news?
I think it's because when we think of black people and illness or death, we think violence. You know, it turns out in this country, violence is a big problem. I don't want to minimize it. There are 30,000 gunshot deaths a year in this country, but there are close to 60,000 deaths from opioid overdose in this country. It's almost double. And so I do think this empathy is a huge deal, because we can only solve this by reinvesting, you know, our enormous wealth back into these neighborhoods and people.
But so much of the focus of the war on drugs was racial, but now the opioid abuse turns out to be largely white.
Yes, and if it allows us at this moment of time to develop empathy for people who are suffering, you know, what happens is people get impoverished, they lose jobs, they lose hope. Drugs is one of the ways they drugs, eating, all these things. And I, you know, if we can develop empathy for these folks and not sort of take the approach that we took during the war on drugs, which was imprisonment and blaming people for their misery, we would do a lot better as a country.
What's the perception gap, and how does that play into perpetuating the factors that contribute to the death gap?
Well, and for, you know, there's a long history of racism and structural racism and racial bias in this country. It used to be the explicit version that we used to see in the 1960s. I talk about structural violence and structural racism as being a cause of mortality. The way we've designed our procedures and laws, like mass incarceration, that keep people from reaching their full potential. But there's a perception gap as well. In other words, I tell the story of buying a house in my community and my mother-in-law seeing a black person walking down the street and saying, oh, you wouldn't want to live here. But these biases that exist in our brain, we all have them. And it's a way for that we navigate uncertain world. And so these flash judgments that we make lead to deterioration of neighborhoods. For example, famous sociologist Robert Sampson found that deterioration of neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, was not caused by the actual deterioration of the neighborhood. It wasn't graffiti, broken windows, or any of that other stuff. It was what determined whether a neighborhood was going to go bad was the perception of the people in the neighborhood. And if the people were black, brown, or immigrants, whether you were black, brown, or white, you perceived that neighborhood as being bad, and it predicted that neighborhood's decline.
And you write that true upward mobility is a myth in the United States society, especially for black people. 80% of blacks and 70% of whites living in high poverty neighborhoods stay stuck in those neighborhoods for generations.
Yes, and when that poverty is concentrated, when you add all of the difficult things that poor people face and you surround people by lots of other poor people, the chances of success, whether that's sex be success in school or a job, but I'm talking about healthier. The idea of inequality, which has grown in this country, and wealth and income inequality has grown. A national issue is one thing, but the idea that you should die prematurely because of that is just an unacceptable proposition.
Now, people have been calling in along these lines. George from the Upper West Side called in and wondered how you figure in the infant mortality rates. Don't they also lower life expectancy?
Yes. You know, I'm talking about the number one cause of death as being heart disease and the second is cancer. But the infant mortality rates in some of these neighborhoods is appalling. And some of this is transmitted from mother to newborn baby. We did a study of looking at this low birth weight in blacks and poor people in Toronto compared to Chicago. And what we found is that the gaps in the United States were double that in Canada and didn't seem in Canada to be related to race or poverty, where in the United States it is. Big contribution.
Because the Canadian healthcare system is one that eliminate some of those problems?
Yes. The three hypotheses were, one is, in Canada, you have health insurance from birth, so you have a whole life of being exposed to access to care, whereas the United States, you may not have it until you get pregnant. But there are other things as well, which is access to education is easier in Canada. And if you're in trouble as a pregnant woman in Canada, in Toronto, you get social services not available in this country.
David from Midtown, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering if there was somewhere on your website that you can input your zip code to find out your life expectancy, and if not, what would be the difference, if you know offhand, of life expectancy living in a middle-class neighborhood in Manhattan versus a smaller city like Kalamazoo, for instance?
It turns out there are some places you can look. University of Washington has this, University of Wisconsin. So if you go look up, and Robert Wood Johnson has put these things out, so if you look up life expectancy and neighborhood, you'll find a whole lot of stuff. And it turns out that if you have a certain amount of money, it doesn't matter what neighborhood you live in anywhere in the country, but where you're poor makes a huge difference. It turns out that the poor in the United States have lower life expectancy than the poor in Costa Rica, for example, whereas the wealthy here do as well as the wealthy anywhere else.
But you say Asians have the highest life expectancy in the United States? Why?
There's a Charles Murray out of University of Washington, who you referenced earlier, has done a very famous paper a number of years ago called The Eight Americas, in which he looked at race, county, and ethnicity, life expectancy. And you can't lump all Asian communities into one bucket. But it turns out Asian Americans have the highest life expectancy, probably due to a number of different factors. Some of them have to do with their community factors and tight-knit communities and things like that. But then they're followed by whites, and then they're followed by Native Americans and blacks at the bottom.
A listener posted on our show page wondering whether the death gap you write about is a signal that the United States, in terms of life expectancy, isn't more like a developing country.
There are, I talk in The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, about black America is an example of a developing country within a superpower. If you look at the statistics on black America in terms of the income, average income is like that of Palestine, the life expectancy is like that of Iraq, it would be on the fragile nations list. And now you can add non-educated white Americans to this. It's a tragedy, and it's atrocious that in this country life expectancy is dropping. In no other developed country is this happening, simply because of the way that we've carried out our public policies writ large, and this current administration's assault really on the poor is just another example of this. And things are going to get worse and not better unless we collectively turn this around.
My guest is David Ansell, Senior Vice President, Associate Provost for Community Health Equity, as well as the Michael E. Kelly Professor of Medicine at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. His previous book was called County, Life, Death, and Politics at Chicago's Public House Hospital. His most recent, the one we're discussing, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, published by the University of Chicago Press. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Dr. David A. Ansel. His latest book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, from the University of Chicago Press. And before we get to more of my questions, I thought I'd put Desmond from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, on the air. Hi, Desmond.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I've got a question for the doctor. In my life's experience, I'm approaching 70, anecdotally and through reading and travel, everything that he stated, I've observed. And what's been happening ever since the end of Jimmy Carter's tenure, the 80s, there has been a diminution of the middle class and increasing class pressure. I mean, and the all the things that he stated about minorities not having any access is true because of institutional racism. No matter the few who are able to elevate themselves becomes has more pressure on them. And now you have whites in this country with the exodus of jobs which only required a high school diploma, not having any access to just basic comfort. The whole point of living in this country was that everybody could basically take advantage of loans and basically have some kind of access to the American dream.
Dr. Ansel, you're nodding your head.
You know, you're absolutely correct. That's exactly what it is, and that's exactly what's happened. And this growing income gap, the growing wealth gap, worsened by the recession of 2007, where wealth was actually, you know, really ripped out of the heart of many communities, not just black communities, but white communities as well. Institutional racism, the hospitals that serve black and brown communities are different. They're lower quality. Across the country, we have an apartheid healthcare system in an overarching way. And there's great evidence to support that has left people really in misery. And the fact of the matter is, we can do something about it. I'm so horrified about this healthcare bill because I see one card system. If we all got the same card, it doesn't solve all these inequities, but at least you would have the ability to go where you need to go. But this healthcare plan that's going to take $800 billion. Out of communities and give it to rich people, it's just going to prolong this sort of national misery that's now affecting white people as well.
But you're supporting a single-payer system. A lot of doctors don't.
Increasingly, listen, doctors never supported Medicare back in 1965. And yet Medicare was one of the more equalizing healthcare ideas we ever came up with. Suddenly, people had a card, and with that card, it desegregated hospitals. It created the potential with a Medicare card. You want to go to Columbia, you go up to Columbia. You know, you want to go to Harlem Hospital, you go to Harlem Hospital, but you could go where you wanted to go. And increasingly, doctors are in favor of it, and certainly the last poll of Americans are in favor of it.
And the AMA is opposed to this new health care bill.
Yes, as are the hospital association. Just about everyone's opposed to it. Think about our economy. The number one employer in the United States used to be manufacturing. It's now hospitals. So if you take $800 billion out of the healthcare system, you know, it's going to affect the whole economy, let alone the lives of people.
Michelle from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, doctor, and thank you for taking my call. I'm an RN. I have a master's in public health, and I've been working on disparities issues for over two decades. And I work in inner city communities. And I think another major factor in sort of the access and quality care gap is the issue related to the lack of providers from communities, from these poor and low-income communities. And I think it's essential that as we shape policy, which I'm totally terrified of this new American Health Care Act as well, is that we're training doctors or, you know, doctors to be from the inner city to provide care to the community. We have a major, major disparity in the number of providers that come from the community. And also, what the doctor is saying, the Institute of Medicine published a report called The Chasm in Healthcare, and it is documented that many times African Americans and other communities of color get poorer quality service.
You're absolutely right, and it's a big problem. You know, I'm a white guy from upstate New York who ended up in urban Chicago, and had I not experienced what I experienced through the eyes, my own eyes and the lives of my patient, I wouldn't have been able to understand this. Most doctors now come from middle class, upper middle class families. They don't come from communities of color. We've not done well with medical schools, and you make a very good point.
You tell a number of stories in this book. One involves a woman named Wendora Bradley, who you met when you were both 27 years old. How long has she been your patient?
Oh, my goodness, since I was 27, and almost 40 years. And it was really through her life and the life of her family and their health that I witnessed this factor, which was a neighborhood factor, that how where you lived affected your care. And as a doctor, you know, here we were, two young people who we met. We got to be close. I've been at her house. I know her kids. But it was almost as if I could not manage the disease in her body.
You use the term structural violence. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I look at, we think about causes of disease, and we think of biological causes of disease. We think the disease is biological or genetic in nature. And yet I pose that structural violence or inequality that's designed into our policies and procedures, our rules of our society, actually cause illness and premature death. It's structural because just like healthcare laws and things you see going on now, or who has access to education or access to safe housing, mass incarceration or structural law, you know, rules and such, and they're violent because they harm people, they kill people. It's not my word. It's Paul Farmer and others have used this.
And that is a factor in the life of Wendora Bradley?
Well, you know, as being her doctor and watching the nature of diabetes, not only in her but in her family, hypertension, obesity, really the runaway diseases that very, very difficult to manage, where people in other neighborhoods do not have the burden of disease. So what happens? How does this happen? Well, you live in a stressful neighborhood. Things happen. You don't have access to good food. You're struggling under the stress of family issues and poverty. It actually creates internal changes, pro-inflammatory factors, stress-related hormones and things that actually accelerate disease.
Even if you have access to good food, it's usually more expensive.
Yes, and we had a conversation one day about the food, and she said she had to send her kids to the corner stores, and they petitioned for the alderman to get a grocery store, but even then they couldn't afford the vegetables. You know, comedian Chris Rock calls Whole Foods the new Jim Crow, because the $7 pear and things that, you know, those of us who have more money take for granted are just literally either non-existent or out of reach.
Brian from the Bronx, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good to talk to you, Leonard. Great show. I'm a physician. I've been working in the Bronx for 32 years. I'm a working class person, became a physician. I want to respond to his point about the empathy gap. Those of us who've worked in underserved communities, we've taken care of folks with addiction for a long time. Where was the empathy before? I'm very pleased that there's empathy now that the opiate problem has come into the white community. But again. And if that leads to treatment for everybody, I'm really happy. But where was the empathy all those years before? So really appreciate your show. Thanks.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you for your service. And you're totally right. You know, I'm just happy that we have an attitude. Sometimes it takes it to happen to white people for us to come with up with some common sense policies.
And he's suggesting that we are paying more attention to the opioid epidemic because so many whites are affected. I hinted at that earlier, when drugs were associated with people of color, it just was a they were the bad guys, and now the white ones are the white opioid people are the victims.
That's how structural racism works. So we had the war on drugs. We've had mass incarceration. When people were dying in inner city New York or Chicago or L.A. from heroin overdoses, no one was calling for the police to revive them with Narcan. Nor did we have white congressmen calling for drug treatment programs. So, but as the caller said, you know, I think we're all happy when something lifts the lives of everyone, and we just hope it applies to everyone.
You tell the story of Mr. M, a 62-year-old black man. Why did he try to kill himself?
The accumulation of stress in his life. So Mr. M has many medical problems. He's an ex-offender. He's got hepatitis C. He's got cirrhosis of the liver. He's got COPD. He's homeless. His mother's sick. His brother's an alcoholic. And as he described it, the stress that he has, you know, was a lot on him, but the stress with his family, but also the stress of being homeless and walking around in neighborhoods that aren't that safe. He describes the cumulative effect as if his head was going to burst. And, you know, as a guy who's about his age, and I'm sitting across the table from him, to say, tell me more. What do you mean? It was like life is not worth living. He wanted to kill himself. And his way of going to kill himself was going to a guy who dealt heroin and take heroin. And so, you know, we don't think of, you know, this type of situation. And again, it's that lack of empathy for the lives of people like Mr. M, for example, that we need to have if we're going to change course in this country.
A number of people have written, called in about the role of insurance companies and the high costs of medical care in this country. Another person has mentioned that there are a lot of doctors who don't take Medicare.
Well, let me just say...
Or Medicaid, actually.
Let me just say the following. As part of the reason in this book, I call our health insurance system the poison pill, because the insurance companies and drug companies in this country are rapacious. They are profit-seeking. They don't exist really to improve the health of people. They exist for one reason, to return money to their shareholders. It's why I argue we need one system of care, one card, like 31 other developed countries, a single-payer improved Medicare for all, where we all get the same card, without co-pays and deductibles. Medicaid expansion has been one of the things with the Affordable Care Act that gave people more coverage. When you get that card, it's better for you. But the problem is many doctors don't take it.
Dr. David Ansell, Senior Vice President, Associate Provost for Community Health Equity, as well as the Michael E. Kelly Professor of Medicine at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. His book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, is published by the University of Chicago Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.